from Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. This is The Exchange. It's Politics Day here on The Exchange, and in this, the last edition of Politics Day in 2010, we ask our analysts to look back at the year that was in politics and to give us their take on the stories and trends with the biggest impact. And then towards the end of the hour, we'll talk about what we're likely to see play out in the political arena in 2011. My guests this hour, political scientist Tim Hagel and communication studies analyst Bruce Gronbeck. What do you see as the most significant political happenings of 2010? What are your hopes or fears for 2011? Join our discussion. Starts right after this news. It's The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Ben Kiefer. Politics Day here on The Exchange, as always on Wednesdays. And my guests this week are Tim Hagel, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Iowa. Bruce Gronbeck is with us by phone, Professor Emeritus of Communication Studies at the University of Iowa. Bruce, you're joining us by phone, a little bit under the weather, but thank you nonetheless for toughing it out and being with us.
If my throat holds up, we'll have a good time.
Okay. Tim Hagel in our studio at Iowa Public Radio in Iowa City. Tim Hagel, welcome back to our program.
Thank you.
And this last edition of Politics Day for 2010, we're asking our analysts to look back at the year that was in politics and to give us their take on the stories, the trends which they see as having the biggest impact. And we'll also talk about what we're likely to see play out in the political arena in 2011. Listeners, what do you see as the most significant political happenings of this year that is almost past? And as we talk about the things mentioned by our analysts this hour, please chime in, 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100, The Exchange at iowapublicradio.org is our email. We're also on Twitter at IPR Talk. Tim Hagel, let me start with you, looking down at your list. What do you want to talk about, first of all, as the major things on our political landscape of this past year?
Well, there are always lots of things to talk about, and this year it seemed, and this is probably true of most years, that a lot of these things are interconnected in various ways. But I suppose one of the dominant topics, I guess you could call it, of the year was the Tea Party movement and its effect particularly on the midterm elections. But you know, well before the midterm elections and really starting in 2009 with the April 15th, that first saw a lot of those activities begun and continued through the town hall meetings that were part of the health care and then into the campaign season for 2010, it seemed that the movement really took off, although in various ways, that sometimes you see it as saw it as a very organized effort in some of the groups out of California. In other places like Iowa in particular, it was a very loose kind of more of a feeling rather than any actual organization.
Mm-hmm. And since the Tea Party had its origins in late 2009, really blossoming in 2010, early on when the Tea Party was mentioned, many people, of course, not people who weren't not in the Tea Party, were saying, well, what is it? What does it stand for? In the course of 2010, has that crystallized, or are there divergent opinions on what the Tea Party stands for?
Well, I think there's still divergent opinions, and sometimes purposefully so, in the sense that a lot of times the people that were not part of and didn't like the Tea Party movement wanted to characterize it in certain ways that would seem to make it negative, so that the hope, I suppose, is that it wouldn't catch on in various ways and that it would just fade away very quickly and not have an effect on the midterms. Excuse me. But I think for the folks that were part of the movement in various ways, it too still has a way to go before it really crystallizes in any sense. Fundamentally, it was an economic sort of thing, looking for smaller government, more fiscal responsibility. But in certain groups, in certain areas, they started to take on some of the more social issues, and that's where you started to even get some divisiveness even within the Republican Party, which is most closely associated with it. But then it also tended to not draw in a lot of the independents and Democrats that the folks that were focusing on the fiscal issues were tended to be able to draw in more.
Mm-hmm. Bruce Gronbeck, when you look back at 2010 and how the Tea Party has developed in this year, what do you see as things, insights that you'd like to share with us?
Well, I think the Tea Party in one sense is is a result of a long-term trend over a couple of decades. Ever since the 1988 presidential election, when less than half of the eligible voters actually voted and weren't participating in a lot of other ways, there have been calls for an engaged and a participatory citizenry that gets involved in politics at the grassroots. And this is, in one sense, a culmination of a whole series of smaller moves to try and engineer that by think tanks, by university research centers, by the parties themselves, to create a new kind of grassroots movement. And it hit. Healthcare seemed to crystallize it with the town meetings through the summer of 2009. Our own senator Chuck Grassley found out when he came home in August that he was almost shocked to find the people and the temperament of the people attending his open meetings. So that I think, in part, it's a long-term trend, and in part, of course, it's a short-term trend. And what Tim said about interlocking issues, the economic situation of the average people in this country being what it is, a great sense of fear about jobs, about what's going to happen to them in their retirement money, about what their kids will have to do when they grow up, and all those sort of things, has created a kind of disease that is it seems to be very thick and very broad. My favorite probably political interest story was the October 29th 60 Minutes episode set in Newton, where you could talk about a great corporation like Whirlpool buying out Maytag and running off and creating a company that was making money hand over fist on the stock market, and then you looked around the town and found that GM is able to pay back the government, but the local dealerships aren't doing so well. The guy who makes pizza has to let most of his workers go and work 12, 14 hours a day and not see his family, and on those individual stories that got at both a sense of anguish and then that strong sense of fear. And it seems to me when we see that kind of coming together in a particular place, in especially, of course, in a by-election year after a new presidency, you're going to expect the tide to start rolling a little, and it just got really big. So it's both a long-term trend and then this time and place where economics and politics in particular come together.
And, of course, the 2008 Republican vice presidential nominee was influential within the Tea Party movement, endorsing and supporting several Tea Party candidates in races across the country this year. Here is a little clip of Sarah Palin. Of course, we're speaking about Sarah Palin speaking at the Tea Party's 2010 convention.
Like Reagan, we know that America is still that shining city on a hill. I do believe that God shed his grace on thee. We know that our best days are yet to come. Tea Party Nation, we know that there is nothing wrong with America that together we can fix as Americans. So from the bottom of my heart, and speaking on behalf of millions and millions and millions of Americans who want to encourage this movement is about the people. Who can argue a movement that is about the people and for the people? Remember, all political power is inherent in the people, and government is supposed to be working for the people. That is what this movement is about.
Sarah Palin speaking February 6th in Nashville, Tennessee at the National Tea Party Convention. She quoted Ronald Reagan there, would like to be seen very much as a Ronald Reagan type of figure there. Tim Hagel, I wonder if you could, she quotes him. To what extent does this movement fit into what we had in Reagan's rise in the national sentiment then?
Well, one of the similarities, I suppose, in terms of the situation is that Reagan, of course, came in at least the year that he ran where he was elected as opposed to the first time in 76. Although the economic situation in 76 wasn't good, it was very bad after 4 years when Jimmy Carter was the president. And so he's coming in. He was trying to give people hope, saying we can do better. We're still a great country. We just need to roll up our sleeves. And that's very similar to Sarah Palin's message. And again, the economic situation, again, is a tough one. And people are complaining in various ways and feeling, as Bruce was saying, that there's this angst out there that people are very nervous about what's going to happen, and she's trying to let them know, hey, we can do this. We've done it before. We can do it again. We need to stay optimistic. And she basically became the voice of the Tea Party of letting people know and speaking for the people and of the people too.
We're surveying the most significant political happenings of 2010, as seen by our analysts this hour. Tim Hagel, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Iowa. Bruce Gronbach joining us by phone, Professor Emeritus of Communication Studies at the University of Iowa. If you'd like to chime in, the topic, specific topic we're talking about right now, the rise of the Tea Party in 2010, or 2010, or any of the other big political news you see on the landscape, 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100, The Exchange at iowapublicradio.org. What does Sarah Palin's, well, let's first talk about the influence that she had and talk about the midterm elections, which I know are on both of your lists as a major part of the landscape politically in 2010. Sarah Palin endorsed a number of candidates for congressional seats, for senatorial seats. Some won, some didn't. How do you read the influence of the Tea Party in our midterm elections? Of course, many Tea Party people now will be sitting in the new Congress.
Oh, absolutely. And as you say, she did endorse a variety of folks from a variety of offices, including Governor Branstad that she endorsed as well, and contributed to a number of these people as well. And I think in some sense that it gave maybe a few people that were undecided, or maybe even some people that had decided but maybe were a little unsure or didn't know a particular candidate, saying, well, hey, this is somebody that Sarah Palin's looked at and we know where she stands on these issues, and so, you know, we can feel more comfortable or not, depending upon, of course, how you feel about Sarah Palin. And so, and that's not unusual. That's usually what happens when you get somebody famous that's endorsing various candidates. And sometimes there are ulterior motives, of course, looking forward, as maybe we'll talk about later. But, you know, person to get their name out. And, of course, being in Iowa, we're sort of expecting that a variety of folks will be coming here and maybe have an interest in running for president in 2012. But at least in terms of the midterm elections, Sarah Palin's endorsements sometimes had an effect, and probably had an effect even if her candidates didn't, her endorsees didn't win. But it still kind of kept that movement going and let people know that, you know, we're out there, we're paying attention, and we're trying to get this smaller government in place.
Bruce Gronbach, as a person who has long studied communication, especially in the political sphere, when you look at the messaging that went into the campaigns heading up to the midterm, where do you see it working, and perhaps where do you see it not working? I'm thinking perhaps in the not working category, the I am not a witch campaign that...
you really want to do that, huh?
That's the one message that stands out for many of us, I think, observing that campaign, right?
Well, and if you want to pick on poor Christine, there's also her assurance that the United States doesn't have the separation of church and state in right. The Constitution. I think the campaign itself for an off-year election especially became much more entertaining than you usually find these kinds of things. In part because when you have something approaching a third-party movement, and I don't think the Tea Party really is. It's not centralized enough to really kind of stand as a political structure. At least, yet that convention that Sarah Palin was speaking at had 500 people attending it, not a groundswell. But the rest of she certainly contributes to that sense of a kind of a political carnival. And I don't mean to use that in a flip way. I think because of all the spectacle that is possible with 24/7 news, with the internet feeds going everywhere, with Sarah Palin having 2.5 million folks on her Twitter account, and all those kinds of things, the multimediated a visualization, really, of the campaign. And yes, you had Christine O'Donnell in her witchery and church-state stuff, and Rand Paul's challenge to civil rights legislation, and his defense of British Petroleum, and Sharon Angle's victory in Nevada over a very strong, actually, Republican candidate taking on Senator Reid. Jen Brewer, down governor in Arizona, pausing when given a tough question about what she thinks about the immigration things. John Boehner's tears, and on. We had a flood of amazing things that could keep us entertained. They provided video clips and YouTube clips and could be circulated again and again. It became a kind of circus that it seems to me didn't serve either the Republicans or the Democrats very well. Their ability to offer and stay on message and on strong themes were almost being melted by that kind of atmosphere. The Tea Party people themselves in their interesting costumes and their funny signs, all of this led to a sort of hoopla that is there to disturb. That's there to disturb politics as usual. And of course, it seems to me that is the goal. The original Tea Partiers, right, were disturbing politics as usual and throwing the tea into the bay instead of letting it go to the shops to be sold. That it seems to me is what stands out. We are in an era of the multimediated or many different kinds of media available to us, bringing political messages. You know, some controlled by the big institutions like television networks, but many just floating around in your computer and mailbox led to much more political interest than I'd ever expect in a by-election.
Join our conversation with Bruce Gronbeck and Tim Hagel, 1-866-780-9100, as we survey the most significant political happenings, trends of 2010, and look on to 2011, 1-866-780-9100, The Exchange at iowapublicradio.org. Andrew is joining us, calling in from East Moline. Andrew, welcome to our program. What are you thinking
Hello,
of when...
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure. When 2010, what will you remember or want to know more about as far as the 2010 political landscape?
Well, I was wondering, I myself must say that I actually take more of my political news from The Daily Show than I do from CNN. And I was wondering what you and your guests thought about the, I guess you would call it, the rise of comedic activism in politics. You saw the Rally to Restore Sanity, which was universally panned, I believe, by a large number of pundits. But, you know, for the people that happen to fall along those lines that, you know, why are we shouting so much? Why don't we just, you know, cooperate and try and come to a consensus that, you know, everyone can sort of agree on. But then also with right here at the end of the year, Jon Stewart basically shaming the Republicans who have so long touted the 9/11 as their banner, then, you know, getting shamed into finally having to vote on something that they were trying to filibuster. And I was wondering what you and your guests thought about, you know, that presence now that we have where it's laughter to the point of political activism.
Okay. Andrew, thank you very much. I want to turn first to Bruce Gronbeck because Bruce Gronbeck was talking about the circuses, the distraction, and this really fits into, especially when we talk about that rally to restore fear and or sanity, a reaction to an earlier rally that Glenn Beck held on the National Mall, Bruce.
Right. We had dueling rallies as part of that circus act. I think the circus was a bit broader first in the case of Stewart and his colleague Mr. Colbert, but interestingly, I'm not sure this year whether the comedic channels and especially the Daily Show had the kind of effect that it might have had. We might have expected it to have.
What makes you think that, Bruce?
Well, it seems to me he was that Jon Stewart was pretty well playing scripts that he regularly uses, which is using all kinds of appeal to satire and even embarrassment to drive home negative messages about usually sitting politicians. And it seems to me that those themes already were out there in the kind of Tea Party discourse that was floating around. And so it seems to me his some of his kinds of nibblings at John Boehner, for example, a regular target this past year, didn't have a lot of bite. That there were other kinds of concerns coming in those popular rallies that seemed to make some of that kind of irrelevant. It seems to me both parties were under attack, in which you could get to another theme if we ever get there, that the Republicans next year, I think, will face some serious problems because the Tea Party corner is not necessarily in their main room. And it could cause them some problems trying to harness that energy. So I don't think that the comedic part was the same at all. I mean, and you could poke fun at dear Christine or at Rand or Sharon Engel and all those people, but it didn't have a lot of traction, I don't think.
Okay, Bruce Gronbeck, thank you. Let's Tim Hagel, how do you weigh in on this Andrew's question from East Moline about the comedy and politics coming together and shows like Colbert, The Daily Show as well?
Well, it's no surprise that Stewart and Colbert have a fairly liberal point of view, and you know this comes through in their comedy on a fairly regular basis. They seem to try to take it a step further, of course, with the rally, which was an attempt to mock the Glenn Beck rally. Well, the Glenn Beck rally really wasn't as political as what people thought it was going to be. It was more about hope and things of that nature. So it left the Stewart rally kind of flat-footed in terms of, well, what do we do here? And if we're just mocking, you know, the political process in general, you know, it's got to do a little bit more than that. And yeah, maybe it has to do with, well, we need to, again, roll up our sleeves and we can come together and get stuff done. Well, it's not that other people haven't been trying to do those sorts of things. Mm-hmm. They just haven't been successful.
If we think about the mocking and the satire coming from the left, The Daily Show and Colbert, where is it? Would it not be a thought that it could also come from the right towards the left? Where is the counterpart coming from the other side of this political spectrum in comedy?
Yeah, it's people have talked about that, why you don't have more, whether it's comedians or entertainers in general, that come from a more right-leaning or conservative point of view. And there are some out there, and you can talk about, well, oh, you know, there maybe there's discrimination in the industry or something like that. People talk about that all the time, but I don't really know. I mean, mm-hmm. You know, that they do have some shows that take this red eye on Fox as a late-night TV show, and, you know, they poke fun at the left on a regular basis, obviously nowhere near as popular as The Daily Show with Jon Stewart. You know, I think that where Stewart kind of lost a little bit of traction was, as long as he's attacking the people in power equally, then, you know, he has a little bit more of a good position to stand on. But when he just takes it in one direction or dominantly in one direction, that makes it a little more tougher for him to come across as more legitimate.
Mm-hmm. Bruce Gronbeck, how do you see that? We have about a minute or so left when comedy comes from all sides of the political spectrum. It seems not to, though.
Well, I think this inherently the right has more difficulty with that. It is attempting to maintain a social order, so it becomes difficult to attack parts of it, I think. And but as well, the Glenn Becks or O'Reillys of the world will certainly use an awful lot of snappy, demeaning, satiric lines, but they don't maintain an act. I can't think of a person right on the spectrum who's been comedic since El Cap in the 60s, for goodness sakes. The last seemed to be very good comedian on a conservative tide as they went after the left with a vengeance in the 60s. I think it's inherently difficult. And you tend as well, it seems to me, on the right to have a more solid, well-set series of values that you're regularly articulating and trying to make the dominant values of a culture. And that doesn't lend itself very well to the comedic, which is always a critique,
Bruce,
a strong critique. Yeah.
Bruce Gronbeck, please hold on.
Yep.
Professor Emeritus of Communication Studies at the University of Iowa, Tim Hagel of the Political Science Department at the University of Iowa, our analysts for this Politics Wednesday, the final in our 20-year of 2010, looking back over the landscape and looking at the significant political happenings, events of this year, and as we move into the second half of the show, on into 2011, how these stories, these events, these movements will have legs in the coming year. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100, the exchange at iowapublicradio.org. Our email, back in just a few minutes. And we're back with The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's Politics Wednesday here on The Exchange. And in this last edition of Politics Day for 2010, we're asking our analysts to look back at the year that was in politics, give us their take on the stories, the trends with the biggest impact, and also, of course, with an eye toward 2011. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100, The Exchange at iowapublicradio.org. Bruce Gronbeck with us, Professor Emeritus of Communication Studies at the University of Iowa. Tim Hagel, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Iowa. We welcome them back to our program, part of a larger pool of analysts we have for Politics Wednesdays. Well, I'd like to jump in with this aspect of 2010 in politics. He's not the most popular guy anymore, if you pay attention to many of the polls. He's taken a lot of casualties, most notably in the November elections, but his list of accomplishments is significant. Healthcare reform, financial industry reform, a repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, a ratification of the New START Treaty, to name a few of them. And here is President Obama, flanked by Vice President Joe Biden, speaking on the night of Congress's vote to approve health insurance reform.
At a time when the pundits said it was no longer possible, we rose above the weight of our politics. We pushed back on the undue influence of special interests. We didn't give in to mistrust or to cynicism or to fear. Instead, we proved that we are still a people capable of doing big things and tackling our biggest challenges. We proved that this government, a government of the people and by the people, still works for the people. I want to thank every member of Congress who stood up tonight with courage and conviction to make health care reform a reality.
President Obama speaking right after the passage of health insurance reform. Clearly a big night for the president. You can hear the pride and excitement in his voice at getting one of his major legislative initiatives through Congress. But when we see what happened in the midterm elections, was this what happened in the midterm elections based a lot on getting this health care reform? Were people reacting against that? To what degree was that true, Tim Hagel?
It really was true. And what was funny about that was in the lead up to all of this that there were some warning signs that people were dubious about what was going on. Of course, the concern over people hadn't read the, you know, thousands of pages in this legislation. They didn't know what was in it. And the way that Obama and his advisors looked at it was that the problem from back in the 90s when Clinton and, of course, call it Hillary Care at the time, and then the big reaction, Republicans took over Congress, that Obama felt that it was the problem there wasn't so much that the Clinton administration tried to reform health care, was that they didn't succeed in doing so. And so they pushed forward despite all the town hall meetings where people were expressing their concerns in very vocal ways, and they thought, well, as soon as we can get this through, then we'll be set. And it turns out that they weren't, because health care became less popular after it was enacted than it was even before. Obama's poll numbers went down. And so the concerns over health care and you know, tied in with the economy in a variety of ways really helped set the stage for the Republicans to take over the U.S. House of Representatives in the latest midterm elections and make significant gains in the Senate.
Now, Bruce Gronbeck, I know you pay a lot of attention to polls, and it's interesting that we hear in the polls that when asked about health care reform, if you just ask one question about health care reform overall, you're more likely to get a negative response than if you ask about the individual parts of the reform that came into effect. What does your look at the polling tell you?
Well, no, that's exactly true. I think that the attack mounted on the health care bill in general was absolutely superb and sophisticated. A great Republican advisor strategist, Frank Lutz, had laid out a full attack plan, and as out of that attack plan, that on the one hand the Republicans got certainly the title of the party of no, but it didn't stick, it didn't hurt. Much more important was the litany of labels. Obamacare, it became what it was called, even though, of course, the bill was a mishmash of lots of different ideas from different people, including Republicans. Death squads.
Including a lot of ideas that the presidential hopeful Mitt Romney
sure.
put forward in Massachusetts during his time as governor.
Right. Very much. Very much. It was, many parts were modeled on the Massachusetts plan. And you know, saddling your children with future debt, and all those kinds of appeals were very scary about the whole bill. And of course, then the public health care rather than private health care, and all that was very good. But I agree with Tim that on the one hand, the Obama administration really couldn't sell the plan as a whole, couldn't really give a clear vision of what it was. And furthermore, when you tie that to together with the economic situation of the country and people having a vision of government Medicare payments and Social Security payments and all the rest of those shooting up, they were very unhappy. So I think it's a major contributor. Now, when you look at the poll numbers overall, Obama's job ratings held about the same throughout the entire year, 2010, always between 45 and 52.3% approval over the whole year. And the same was true if you asked about his position on the economy. Now, that was in the low 40s, but again, it didn't vary very much.
Mm-hmm. How much does a president, a sitting president, have to worry about approval ratings? Obviously, in the run-up to an election, a presidential election, you have to worry a lot. But in the position that Obama has been in the first 2 years, was popularity very much on his radar?
I think it has to be. It has he certainly keeps talking about health care in particular, you know, I'm willing to go down to get this passed, words to that effect that he said. On the one hand, he doesn't care about it. But if he doesn't have the public behind him and what we've called the rhetorical presidency since Roosevelt, if he doesn't have the public behind him, he loses an amazing amount of leverage inside the Beltway. And so it is very important for him, I think.
Tim Hagel, your thoughts on the president's, any president's popularity and their effectiveness in getting their agenda through?
Oh, it can be very critical. It'll depend a lot on the particular situation and the issues that are involved. But when a president's popularity is low, then members of Congress don't feel the need to follow his lead, as it were. We saw this happen to Jimmy Carter when his presidential popularity numbers got really low. Even though he had a Democratic Congress to work with, they didn't feel that they really needed to pay as close attention to him, and so they were able to go their own way. When a president comes in, the numbers are usually pretty high, and so there's like this honeymoon period. But if those numbers start to drop precipitously, then Congress can either do what it wants or they'll start paying more attention to their own voters and be more concerned about their own electoral prospects rather than worrying about the president's agenda.
Republicans swept into Congress in the 2010 midterm elections. Many Tea Party activists will be joining the new Congress when it's sworn in January on a wave of voter dissatisfaction with the status quo. Here's an emotional John Boehner speaking on election night as he was learning he would soon become the Speaker-elect of the U.S. House.
I spent my whole life chasing the American dream. Listen, I had a lot of you know I started out mopping floors, waiting tables, and tending bar at my dad's tavern. I put myself through school, working every rotten job there was, and in every night shift I could find. And I poured my heart and soul into running a small business. And when I saw how out of touch Washington had become with the core values of this great nation, I put my name forward and ran for office. So I'm going to thank my wife, Debbie, my girls, Lindsay and Tricia, my 11 brothers and sisters, and all my friends and neighbors in Ohio for giving me the chance to serve and the opportunity to stand before you ready to lead. Thank all.
A very emotional John Boehner there, learning that he would become the Speaker-elect of the U.S. House of Representatives. An interesting moment when we look at it from the political rhetoric and so forth here. It doesn't happen very often that you have a politician of that stature getting that emotional, Tim Hagel.
Yeah, it is. And I like John Boehner, but it almost sounded like he was giving a victory speech after having won the presidency or something like that in terms of what it is that, you know, he really all he won was his seat in Congress. And of course, because so many other Republicans won and the Republicans are going to be the majority party and he was the presumptive speaker of the House at that point, it seemed a little over the top. But, you know, he's, I suppose, an emotional guy and that's fine. But it does.
What you cry for, too, right? Edmund Muskie cried when his family he thought was under attack in 1972 and was swept out of the Democratic race for the nomination because it was personal. It seemed to be a personal weakness. In this case, Boehner's story is so well sculpted. It's a great mythic kind of melodrama as he rises above circumstance that I think it probably does him some good, especially for this cigar-chomping, golf-playing guy. It balances his personality, I think, and will make him, in one sense, just more formidable.
Isn't it interesting, though, to ponder what if a female politician of that stature, say a Hillary Clinton, had gotten that choked up in front of the cameras? What would we have had happen, Bruce?
they can't cry, you know.
Women can't cry at that. No. As politicians.
There's a nice song about girls not being able to cry. Well, if my voice were better, I could sing it first.
Maybe next time when that flu bug is out the door. Before we got done with, did you have a comment on that, Tim Hagel?
I just don't see Hillary Clinton crying. No, I think she can get emotional too. But I remember Pat Schroeder a number of years ago, former representative from Colorado, who had run for the presidency, and when she finally realized that she needed to drop out, there was some tearing, and there were some stories about that. And I think people have talked about how there is kind of a double standard in all of this. Mm. But I'd agree with Bruce that probably it depends on the circumstances, of course. But they're probably on the whole, it's the showing of emotion, and people will generally approve or at least accept it.
Before our hour gets away from us, I wanted to talk a few minutes about the state stories of political interest in 2010, and let's talk quickly about those. Bruce Gronbeck, when you look back at politics in Iowa, what will you remember about this year?
Well, certainly in general, it is the cleaning of the House of state government by the Republicans. Not quite getting the Senate, but pretty well handling everything else. So I think that the story that will stick, and certainly the story that circulated around the country, was the judicial recall. And to have a citizen referendum sweep in and carry out three judges in what is normally a very passive reaffirmation kind of process, what was an amazing story. And I think it is a story that, on the one hand, of course, fits 2010 perfectly, the grassroots, grounds-up kinds of movements that swept in. And on the other hand, it is, as I suspect those resisting that referendum feared, a shift in understanding how our government should run, that a bottom-up, people-driven or public opinion-driven or a public vote-driven kind of referendum should be governing the state, with shades of California, for goodness sakes, though thank goodness not quite the same way, is going to give a lot of politicians in the state, in the House and in Senate, a pause on how they can proceed and what they should be doing about this.
Mark in Cedar Rapids writes on this very point. He writes, I was shocked to hear that Iowans believe in majority rule with the Iowa Supreme Court judges. Majority rule is fine until you find yourself in the minority, writes Mark in Cedar Rapids. And Tim Hagel, when we look on to the next year, what are the longer-term implications of the ousting of these three justices? And we know also a campaign by Bob Vanderplaats to actually impeach the remaining justices who were not up for retention on this ballot.
Yeah. I'll say first that I was completely surprised that the campaign to reject the three justices was successful, that studying judicial politics is my main area, and it's just almost impossible to actually get people out of office under the merit system. And so this was a big surprise. That said, and given that I was wrong the first time, I'll say I don't think that any campaign to impeach the remaining four justices will be successful for a couple of reasons. One, that as time goes on, I think people will not be as intense about this particular issue on either side of the camp. But also there's, I think, a fundamental difference between simply voting no to not retain a justice versus saying you want to impeach somebody, and then, of course, it's going to go to to the state legislature. So there's a big difference there. I don't think it'll happen. And I see a lot of stories, particularly right after Election Day, people saying, oh, this is a fundamental change. This is a big shift. We can't have this kind of a thing. I just don't see a lot of that happening. I think that maybe what'll happen, as you're suggesting, is that it will give a number of government officials, including judges and justices, a bit of pause, saying, okay, you know, we do have to pay attention to what the people want here. And you know, people say, oh, independent judiciary, but they're political animals too.
Mm-hmm. We'll also get an indication what the legislature will react. I suspect pretty soon is Vanderpool. I think the news story you had at noon, at the noon break, was that he'll be carrying this now in his rationale into the legislature, and then we'll see if it gets any traction pretty quickly.
We have 3 or 4 minutes left. I wanted to mention also a big story later in 2010 to have you comment on that, the WikiLeaks story. Is it a sort of a democratization of information, or is it espionage? You're reading on the what happened in WikiLeaks, the implications of it. Is it, for instance, a Pandora's box that inevitably would have to have been opened, given our information technology progress? And is the landscape forever then changed? In what way? Tim Hagel.
I think it probably is. I think it's one of these things where the government has its old ways of doing things, and even though it keeps up in a variety of ways, the sort of the new internet and the web and how information gets around. I was just reading an article the other day about how it's, once information gets out like this, it's almost impossible to put that genie back in the bottle. And so government will react in a variety of ways because there are certain reasons why government needs to keep certain things secret. You want to have particularly information that's flowing from advisors to the principals, to the president in particular, that, you know, sort of a candid assessment that you can say between coworkers that's not going to be the public face of things, particularly when you're dealing with allies or even other countries and things of that nature. And so you're probably going to have to change the way you do business a little bit, but it still makes it very difficult to deal with the particular situation right now in terms of well, what do we do with Assange? What do we do with the supposed private that leaked this information? Is this treason? Is it espionage? Well, we're going to have to wait and see what happens.
We have GOP hopefuls say that Julian Assange should have been or should be executed, or the person who fed WikiLeaks that information, who is an American citizen. What would you think will be the lasting impact, Bruce Gronbeck? How will we view the WikiLeaks event of 2010 in 5 or 10 years, perhaps?
Well, you mentioned time, and that's a good thing because, of course, those diplomatic cables, for example, from the November leak, usually start circulating 10, 20, 30, 40 years after the events have occurred, and they become a great place for economic and diplomatic historians to do their work. Now they have them in their hands right now, and suddenly it's a whole different kind of game. It is now not a looking back, but it is a looking into. And I think that is a major kind of impact. Now, the fact that we've been those Republicans and others that you mentioned have been going back to the 1917 Espionage Act to find something strong enough to make charges of treason with all the kinds of penalties that can come from that charge is very interesting. That is, which is, it seems to me, a signal that we've not done a very good job of still figuring out what happens when hackers get into government computers. They've been trying to do that since the 70s.
Bruce Gronbeck, yep. and Tim Hagel, before we have to go, each of you have a minute here. We have 2 minutes left in the show. I want to ask you and leave the program by asking you, what are you looking most forward to on the political landscape in 2011? What can't you wait to see how it plays out? Tim Hagel.
Well, of course, as a political scientist, I'm looking forward to the caucuses and seeing what happens here. Some people have said that we've had a bit of a slow start, but that's really not the case. If you look back, not so much for the last presidential cycle, but back to, say, 2000, where things didn't really get rolling until later in the spring. But we have a number of sort of candidates who are sort of circling Iowa, coming in, stepping, put a little toe in the water, that sort of a thing. And so it'll heat up as the spring goes along.
And we'll certainly have a lot of politics. Politics Wednesday is devoted to political candidates vying for that GOP nomination. Bruce Gronbeck, 30 seconds, 40 seconds for you.
On the one hand, I'm certainly looking forward to seeing what the Obama administration can do now that it picked up a little momentum and some small jumps anyway in the polls. But like Tim, I'm mostly interested in the caucus, and particularly this time around, of course, the Republican because you have these people, poor people, trying to straddle, as they did, not very successfully in 2008, the social or value Republican conservatives with the economic political conservatives. And that's a tough straddle to make. And who among them can do that? That, for me, will be the big question.
And do we know when exactly Sarah Palin will declare her intentions? Or do you believe indirectly she's already done that, Bruce?
I believe that she's not going to run. I think she was scarred up pretty badly in August, September, October 2008. She's got a great position now where she can be a pundit and still make money with her documentary biopics and her books and everything else. I think she's having a great time.
Final few seconds to you, Tim Hagel.
I'd agree on the Sarah Palin thing that I think she's probably has more influence where she is now than if she tries to run again.
Okay, thank you very much. Tim Hagel, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Iowa, and Bruce Gronbeck, Professor Emeritus of Communication Studies at the University of Iowa. Tim, Bruce, thank you for joining us.
Welcome.
An extra shout-out to Bruce. You get well, Bruce.
I'll work on it. Thanks.
All right. The Exchange is produced by Catherine Perkins and Alex Hoyer. Production assistance today from Mitchell Schmidt and Lindsay Moon. Technical support from Dennis Reese. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Jeff Schmidt. Podcasting and on-demand audio of The Exchange available at iowapublicradio.org. The Exchange is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.